Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. What are you doing for Earth Day? Yeah, today's Earth Day. Do you celebrate? Do you observe? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Take your suggestions or your best practices, some ritual sacrifice you do on Earth Day.
It could be romantic, too.
For example?
Well, for example, back in the day when I worked at Channel 5, we put an intern and his girlfriend on dumpster diving. Like, they dove for their dinner. So disgusting. But they went to fancy restaurants. And it was, you know, about... just, you don't have to pay for the dinner because you can find it in the dumpster and then you sit
always,
down and
sure.
have a picnic. I'm not kidding you. What was that kid's name? He was
with
so
food
sweet.
Prices. That may be a useful exercise.
Yeah, maybe, but that was on Earth Day.
Need to be prepared for that. Earth Day, of course, is this Marxist-inspired a day of observance for the secular humanists among us. This was just so we remember this because it'll be papered over by this. The brain dead network newscasts and their affiliates as they show people picking up trash or whatever and pretending that Earth Day is about conservation, Earth Day is about politics. It was proposed by some hippie doofus, I repeat myself, named John McConnell in San Francisco in 69. It was adopted by proclamation by the United Nations. It wouldn't have gone anywhere without the support of the UAW in its early days. So this is, you know, the left celebrating the left and their God, to the extent that their God isn't themselves. It's Mother Gaia, the Earth, and they need to protect it from the humans. So, yeah, it's this should be an object of ridicule, but number one, first and foremost. But number two, also an opportunity to maybe have a teachable moment with some folks. Maybe do a little bit of stop, look, and listen about what they think they understand about the climate or the environment generally versus what is actually true. Maybe introduce them to someone they're not familiar with or someone's writings they have not been exposed to better inform their view, maybe.
I'm going to be really busy Sunday.
Busy Sunday, why?
No, at the church, if I'm going to do that, show them
oh,
that.
Oh, no, you don't have to be busy. Just, I'll tell you what, in a single document, in a relatively concise one, I'll just pass out Michael Schellenberger's apology he posted at his website, environmentalprogress.org, on June 29th of 2020. We should observe this every year in this day and age, what Michael Schellenberger had to say.
Environmentalprogress.org.
Yeah, Michael. Exactly. Michael Schellenberger used to write on environmental policy for Forbes. He's the author of a number of books, most recently on San Francisco. We've had him on the show, usually attendant to a book being out, which is great. I mean, he's really good. This apology that he made, San Francisco. Is his latest book. The last time I think we spoke to him was when Apocalypse Never came out. So here's who Michael Schellenberger is, and this is from his apology. We went over it, but like Earth Day, we should celebrate this every year. At 17, I lived in Nicaragua to show solidarity with the Sandinista Socialist Revolution. At 23, I raised money for Guatemalan women's cooperatives. In my early 20s, I lived in the semi-Amazon doing research with small farmers fighting land invasions. At 26, I helped expose poor conditions at Nike factories in Asia. I became an environmentalist at 16 when I threw a fundraiser for Rainforest Action Network.
Wow.
At 27, I helped save the last unprotected ancient redwoods in California. In my 30s, I advocated renewables and sexually helped persuade the Obama administration to invest $90 billion in them. Over the last few years, I helped save enough nuclear plants from being replaced by fossil fuels to prevent a sharp increase in emissions. So that's his credentializing himself as a dutiful left-wing environmentalist. And for most of his time as an environmentalist, as he admits, a climate alarmist. And he was wrong. And he is apologizing for it. So in response to...
How dare you!
Michael Schellenberger has this to say in this apology. Here are some facts few people know. You know if you listen to this show, because we talked to the Michael Schellenbergers and the Bjorn Lombergs and the Patrick Moores of the world. We need to get to... That would be that. Now, that's a Earth Day celebration, having those
Patrick
three gentlemen.
Moran. Oh, yeah.
The co-founder of Greenpeace. Here are some facts few people know. Michael Schellenberger writing. Humans are not causing a sixth mass extinction. The Amazon is not the lungs of the world. Climate change is not making natural disasters worse. Fires have declined 25% around the world since 2003. The amount of land we use for meat, humankind's biggest use of land, has declined by an area nearly as large as Alaska. The buildup of wood fuel and more houses near forests, not climate change, explain why there are more and dangerous fires in Australia and California. Carbon emissions are declining in most rich nations and have been declining in Britain, Germany, and France since the mid-1970s. Netherlands became rich, not poor, while adapting to life below sea level. We produce 25% more food than we need, and food surpluses will continue to rise as the world gets hotter, unless we impose self-inflicted wounds like supply chain disruptions and war, of course. My parenthetical comment. He continues, habitat loss and the direct killing of wild animals are bigger threats to species than climate change. Wood fuel is far worse for people and wildlife than fossil fuels. Preventing future pandemics requires more, not less, industrial agriculture. So, you know, on this Earth Day, what do you know versus what do you think you know? Who is really blah, blah, blahing and who is not?
There is no planet B. There is no planet blah. Blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah.
That makes me laugh.
Blah, blah, this is not blah. About some expensive, politically correct green act of bunny hugging or blah, blah, blah. Build back better, blah, blah, blah. Green economy, blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah. Net zero by 2050, blah, blah, blah. Net zero by 2050, blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah. Blah. Net zero, blah, blah, blah. Climate neutral, blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah.
I speak Swedish too.
One of the great intellects of our time.
Blah, blah, blah.
So, you know, as is always the case, the left, even those sort of marginally connected to reality, the tools of the left, like Greta Thunberg, unfortunately for her, project onto the Michael Schellenbergers who they are. They're blah, blah, blahing, and, I mean, the trained seals applauding along. You're applauding blah, blah, blah. Like she's... essentially
goddess.
Telling some emperor yep. that he has no clothes. In point of fact, they know nothing. And so...
Is she a scientist? Does she have a scientific background? Does she even graduate high school yet?
You don't need any of that. You just need to follow fairly straightforward where the evidence leads. Schellenberger's book, Apocalypse Never, He points the way forward. He doesn't just debunk the talking points of the blah, blah, blahers. For example, factories and modern farming are the keys to human liberation and environmental progress. So don't believe what the neo-Luddites have to say. The most important thing for saving the environment is producing more food, particularly meat, on less land. The most important thing for reducing air pollution and carbon emissions is moving from wood to coal, to petroleum, to natural gas, to uranium, meaning nuclear. 100% renewables would require increasing the land use for energy from today's 0.5% to 50%, 50.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. You ready for a 100-fold increase? 100% renewables, let me repeat that, would require increasing the land use for energy from 0.5% today to 50%. This is coming from somebody who used to be an advocate for renewables, as he mentioned. Got $90 billion lobbying the Obama administration for renewables. We should want cities, farms, and power plants to have higher, not lower, power densities. Vegetarianism. Leading the way with, you know, virtue signaling your diet. Vegetarianism reduces one's emissions by less than 4%. Greenpeace did not save the whales, switching from whale oil to petroleum, and palm oil did. Free-range beef would require 20 times more land and produce 300% more emissions. It's like talking about the emissions that go into producing the component parts, the emissions that are dispersed, producing the parts required to build those windmills that are going to save us from fossil fuels. Uh-huh. Greenpeace's dogmatism worsened forest fragmentation of the Amazon, not doing anything to save it. But, of course, we continue to be misled by those who do have environmental credentials, do have some background in science, although many do not, including one of the worst offenders, Bill Nye, the science guy. You know, his environmental alarmism got him a show on Netflix, as bizarre as that would. He's just a bizarre little guy. And he's from Naperville, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But anyway, the exposure to Michael Schellenberger for the purposes of exposing truth versus the fictions that are promulgated by the left, that, to me, seems like a worthy endeavor on this Earth Day. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Just when you thought you could stop thinking and talking about masks, you have not only the DOJ at the behest of the CDC appealing the injunction handed down by a Florida district court, federal district court judge. You also have LA County ordering a return to masks on public transit, rideshare, and LAX despite the federal rules. Out of an abundance of caution, because they're monitoring the data, of course. Their version of Allison Arwadi, Barbara Ferrer, the order is based on the CDC's opinion that mask wearing on transit remains an essential step in preventing the spread of COVID. They are experts. They made a determination. You shall follow their determination regardless of what a federal judge says, regardless of what the law is. We make our own law in L.A. Uh-huh. Yeah, okay. And the D.C. press corps is following along nicely. Try to keep this front and center in your mind. I don't know that it's going to work, but that doesn't mean that they won't try. Dr. Kavita Patel is a contributor, medical contributor.
At NBC, right? Yeah.
To NBC, and this is what she had to say.
If people want to stay safe, the best thing they can do, high-quality masks, and that when possible, carry some extra masks. I know this sounds crazy, but if you tell someone next to you on a plane, KN95, and just say, or surgical mask, and just say, I've got an elderly mother at home, I've got a child with cancer at home, will you please do me a favor? Having the people at least closest to you in that row, protecting yourself and them, can be the best safety. So carry some extra masks with you. Carry some rapid tests with you if you're traveling.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so right. She could be like that idiot CPS teacher who tested herself on the way to Iceland, remember, and was in the bathroom then quarantining on the plane, and then she quarantined at a hotel and ruined her whole trip.
Carry some N95 masks to you so you can lie to the people sitting next to you and tell them you have a kid at home with cancer so that they'll put an N95 mask on.
I'm not doing that.
I want someone to try doing that because if they try more than once after I politely decline, then we could have a Mike Tyson moment on that plane.
I will never forget at the beginning of this, I was swimming outdoors at Elk Grove Pavilion. And a lady in between, a lady in the lane next to me, I was talking to a guy, and she said, "Can you please stop talking? You're spreading germs, and I have a 90-year-old mother at home who's got a compromised immune system."
Yeah, okay.
And we looked at her like, "We are outside. You are 10 feet away from me. Shut up and keep swimming." Mm-hmm. You know, like, shut up and dribble, shut up and paddle.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA. Just to play out that scenario, it would be kind of fun if somebody tried to shame you into wearing a mask through some sort of appeal, real or more likely. Apparently, in the case of Dr. Patel, she'd just make it up, real or not real. Would you comply? If somebody said, "Would you put a mask on because I would feel more comfortable if you had a mask on? And oh, by the way, just in case you won't do it for me, please do it for my immunocompromised grandparent or child." How about that? Would the heartstrings work on you?
At this point in time, I'm going to have to say no. I would just slowly walk away from that person. That would be the best that I could do.
Well, you're not walking away from them if you're sitting next to them.
If I'm on a plane, though, and they said that to me, I'd just say, you know what? I'm not going to do it. And I've got 170-plus studies in my possession about the inefficiency of masks, whether they be surgical, KN95s, whatever you want to call them, or cloth masks, and I'm not doing it. I did everything the government asked me to do, and I still got COVID.
Yeah.
And my mom got boosted and double boosted. She still got COVID. And I know people that have had the four shots that have gotten COVID for the second
time.
Yeah,
so does everybody.
Yeah.
So that's a good way to do it.
That's what I would explain to the person.
No, that's a good way to do it, is what you're suggesting is you would come back by being more annoying than the person who asked you to put a mask on. That's a good play. I like that play.
And then I'd keep talking incessantly. Right. And then lean over and they're seeing like, "So tell me about yourself," and then breathe all over. Like,
for the next 3 hours on this flight, let me tell you my position on masks.
Let me tell you a little bit about this.
It all started back in March of 2020.
When they told us it would be just 2 weeks.
The memory road with me, if you will, for just a moment. That's actually a pretty good way to do it. You don't have to get persnickety. Just bore them to tears.
And then I could bring up maps of America that I have stored when it comes to in-person learning and sports that were being played all over the country. You know, and how our unmasked neighboring states were doing actually better than us than we were at certain periods during this pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly.
Then I could get out stats.
You know, it's interesting you bring up masks. Did you see that City Journal piece where they charted from the beginning to the beginning of this year?
I actually
24% infection rate in states with mask mandates, 24% infection rate in states without mask mandates. Mm-hmm. The actual per capita death rate in states with mask mandates was a little higher than in states without mask mandates. Here, let me show you some charts and graphs, and then we'll really start digging into the numbers. You're a person of data and science. This is going to be fun. That would be fun.
I
like that.
Yeah, I got taken a test for, say, 952 healthy kids are at home, from being denied entry into schools. And people are like, "They're sick." And you know how many kids were actually sick? The positivity rate was 0.27%. And it was a total of 56 kids out of 952.
Mm-hmm. This is wonderful.
More
examples of what... and then make sure you go through the red, yellow, green.
Oh, that's right. And then the districts, because we had districts, and then we had a COVID bridge. I could talk about that.
Yeah.
COVID bridge. Who thought of
that? I would put a mask on, but my understanding, I don't know if you've consulted the map and to see where which DEFCON we're at right now, but red, yellow, green for COVID infection rates. And we're in a yellow. And until we're in a red, I don't feel comfortable putting a mask on. You know what I'm saying? Let's go through it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 646-36, type in D DA than a quick comment. What would you say, Dan, when you fly home sometime soon?
I would just say, I'll take you face value. I'm sorry you're irrationally afraid, if that makes you feel safer, then that's fine. But I'm not going to do it. But now that I hear you talking about it, instead of going Mike Tyson on somebody, and then having to worry about assault and battery charges, I think the better play is that it's just I'm going to unload for the next 2 hours everything I know about the science and data behind mask wearing historically, as well as over the last 2 years. So settle in. No bathroom breaks on this flight for you, miss, because we got a lot to talk about. I like that approach.
Yeah.
Bruce in Waukesha.
Morning, Dan and Amy. I work for a limo service that does a lot of work between Milwaukee and Chicago, and I had a situation one day where a lady got in the car, and this is kind of like within the last, month, and she insisted I wear a mask, and I said, I'm sorry, I don't have a mask. And she said, well, I've got two children at home, and she used that line on me. And I just I really wanted to say to her that your two children are not in the car, so that's the first problem. But I did not wear a mask, and she was kind of really upset, kind of could tell just she didn't say it. But I just, this is where people have to stand up and stand their ground, because otherwise these people will just run us over for the rest of our lives.
Thanks for the call, Bruce. I would have maybe on that one, like if the I have two children at home, if you're not on a plane, could you call them? Because I'd like to say something to them.
That their mother's a little wacko.
Run. Run.
Go now.
She's coming back.
Hurry up.
Yeah. Okay. Amish Texture on the Tin Can and String hotline.
Yeah, I'm going to start carrying a condom just for these types of situations. And if someone leans over to me on a plane and tells me that they want me to wear a mask, I'm going to say, I'm a birthing person. I'd like you to wear a condom just to prevent me from getting accidentally pregnant here, okay? Because it makes it much sense.
All right. Thanks, Amish. Dennis, Crystal Lake.
Hi, Dan and Amy.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, just to let you know, for Earth Day, I'm going to be pumping half a billion gallons of raw sewage. I hope to see some of yours in there.
Oh, gross.
And
okay.
Anyways, I was in a little food market in my neighborhood, and old ladies kept coming up to me. They're following me around. Tell me to wear a mask. I said, get out of here. I don't have a mask. And then they surrounded me like jackals. And I go, I'm not wearing a mask. And there was a little old lady. She must have been 90. She talked me into, she gave me a mask. I go, is this what you want me to put on? And I was already checked out. And
so
I go, okay, just to make you happy. And I went to put, and I go to put it on, and I had a bad cold. I blew my nose right into that damn thing, threw it on the floor, and I said, clean it up.
Oh, Dennis.
And that was it.
Hey, Dennis, how's your love life lately? Still picking up chicks at the bar?
I'm going real good.
Yeah. Doing real good.
I'm going over to China to, work their embassy.
Okay, all right, Dennis. Bye-bye. Right. He's going to use the old, I got a free pass out of the Shanghai lockdown. Yeah. Use that. Why, Dennis?
Remember, Dennis is the one who said, I try to pick up these broads. I'm making six figures over here.
Yeah.
And they're
exactly.
not giving me any attention.
Yeah. They're not giving me the time of day. What's the guy got to do? Huh? the whole Dennis at the food mart, too, that conjured visions in my head of Dan Rostenkowski being hounded by seniors in his district at a gas station over, what was it? I think of something with respect to Medicare or Social Security. Yeah. But yet Dennis being hounded by little old ladies at his food mart in Crystal Lake or wherever. Yeah.
Reminds me of that caller who said he got chased by a guy carrying a price gun telling him to put a mask on.
Yeah, a lot of chase scenes in the era of the mask wearing. Frank,
remember
and
the one
Heights.
Way, like you have to walk this way down the one aisle? Oh, you don't go to grocery stores, so you don't know what I'm talking about.
Frank and Arlington Heights.
Good morning. One of my favorite movies is Legends of the Fall with Anthony Hopkins
and Brad Pitt. And
who else?
Brad Pitt. And
the kid from E.T.
Who?
The kid from E.T. was his younger brother who got killed in the war.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, the kid from E.T. I don't know his name. Yeah,
yeah,
that's right.
I got his name, too.
But I always loved Anthony Hopkins' character. He was very, suspicious of government in general.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so when my dad, we always called my dad because, you know, he wasn't, he's conservative, too. So my brother and sister and I would call him, Colonel Ludlow, sir! And so what we did when he got out of his, he had a surgery once. So what I did for him was I bought him remind him of that. I bought him a chalkboard as a gift when he got out of a surgery that he had. And
love it.
We've always just called him that. And I'm not going to imitate Colonel Ludlow here. I think that might be a little bit beyond the pale. But when we see him sometimes, I just go up to him. And I go, Colonel Ludlow, sir, how are you, sir, today?
I like the idea. So what are you going to do if how does that relate to what you're going to do if you run into somebody who asks you to put a mask on? Are you going to wear a chalkboard around your neck and start scrawling messages on it, pretend you can't speak?
I'm thinking once school is over and I go down to Florida, I think I'll wear the chalkboard. I got a chalkboard from my dad. I'll wear that and have the piece of chalk there just as kind of like a preventive measure. I don't know if anybody's going to, you know, nobody will probably know it, but I'll just wear that chalkboard. Then just in case somebody asks me, I'll start writing down.
That's pretty good.
Colonel Ludlow.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Yeah,
it was Henry Thomas who played Samuel.
Henry Thomas, of course. Yeah, Henry Thomas. And of course, Aidan Quinn. Yeah, that was the middle brother.
Oh.
If I'm not mistaken, and I'm usually not.
If you're wrong, I'm not going to tell you anyway.
And the love interest, she also was in that, she had a little run there. She did a movie with Harrison Ford, too, but remember Julia Ormond.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Julia Ormond. She played Susanna.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember it well. Pete in Milwaukee. Hey, Pete.
Good morning. I want to start by saying that 4 years ago, my wife had mantle cell lymphatic cancer, stage 4. 3 years ago, she had a stem cell transplant. So we have done much discussing about masks and everything else. But because of COVID, that if you wear a mask, that does not give you a get-free out-of-jail pass. You are still at high risk for many other things along with COVID. And we determined at a certain point that my wife wasn't wearing a mask. When we get on the plane, she does. But people that are at high risk are at high risk for viruses, colds, flu and everything else. It doesn't go away because of COVID.
All right, good point. Thanks for the call, Pete. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, you mentioned, Amy, the passing of CNN Plus after that historic 3-week run. Tucker Carlson had this to say about the demise of CNN's streaming service.
So we're mourning, as we told you a moment ago tonight, the involuntary retirement of Mike Wallace's son. Boo-hoo. No more lectures on TV.
A lot of Schadenfreude attendant to the departure of CNN Plus.
See, even Hayek is upset that CNN Plus is gone.
Yeah, exactly. I should have said that more quietly.
But they said they're going to, you know, reassign the hundreds of staff members that, you know, they took over. But this has been in the works for 2 years.
Yeah, that's a good try. $300 million wasn't quite enough to make anybody watch.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This is how it went down in the Florida State House of Representatives yesterday when the House moved to vote the legislation that would remove the Reedy special use district from Disney World, essentially.
Right.
Disney World would no longer govern itself. It would be subject to the governance of the counties it covers.
And henceforth pay millions of dollars more in taxes.
Mr. Speaker, I move the previous question on the bill.
Representative Renner moves the previous question on the bill. This motion is not debatable and requires a majority vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Show the bill. Show if motion passes. We will now proceed to call the previous question.
Donald J. Trump is now President of the United States.
It's the same lady.
I think it's the same person.
I think it's a great honor to be able to introduce for the first.
I think it's pretty much the same person. Yeah, was it a woman?
It was a woman. It's not.
It was sort of a pat. It wasn't.
No, it was.
Yeah, it was a pat.
No, I don't know. She looked like. Why? I shouldn't say that.
Yeah,
I don't know what she was identifying as that day, so I don't want to offend her.
Yeah, it was a pat. So anyway, that pat apparently roams around looking for moments to scream in horror when something happens that Pat didn't like, and so that's what happened yesterday. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line, goes to DeSantis' desk. He's going to sign it. Is this unfair and inappropriate political retribution against the Disney Corporation? Is this an overreach by DeSantis? And I ask because that is what some on the right are suggesting it is.
Really?
Jenna Ellis, she's one of Trump's former attorneys. If California was retaliating against Chick-fil-A, conservatives would be mad. If Disney spoke out against the abortion bill in California and the government retaliated like Florida, conservatives would be mad. I disagree with Disney, but the government can't retaliate. Protecting free speech for all matters. What do you think? Is that what this is? Protecting free speech for all or isn't? This is retaliation, and it runs afoul of Disney's free speech rights, I guess. Jenna Ellis is arguing.
Let's go back to how this whole thing started. Was it over critical race theory and the gay bill that they said?
It wasn't critical race theory. It was gender ideology in K-3.
Yeah.
Right. So is DeSantis overreaching here? If DeSantis and a supermajority of Florida Republicans in the State House and State Senate who voted this up to his desk.
Well, what do you think?
Free speech argument? She's supposed to be an attorney, right?
Right.
How is this a free speech issue? This is an infringement upon Bob Chapek or Abigail Disney's free speech rights? How? How does a special designation from a government that was offered up, 55 years ago? That's not enshrined in the Florida State Constitution. There's no commitment that it shall exist in perpetuity. Not that you could bind future legislatures anyway. Not with something that's a statutory designation. It's not a fundamental right. So if you're removing a designation that is not a fundamental right, how is that an abridgment of a fundamental right like freedom of speech? Is government silencing someone here? Can Bob Chapek or Disney executives still not speak out against the bill?
Well, they can speak out all they want. they can have walkouts. They have them every day.
Sure they can.
For their lunch breaks, they'd walk out. Yeah, no one stopped them from doing that.
Sure they can.
He just wants them to pay their fair share.
So that's not a very compelling response, in my estimation, from Jenna Ellis. Charlie Cook over at National View also objects. He makes a little bit better argument. He writes, yes, Disney isn't entitled to this arrangement, but Disney wasn't entitled to it in 2012, 2002, 1992, 1982, or 1972 either. And yet, amazingly enough, the legislature showed zero interest in rescinding the taxing district, the special district, when given the opportunity on those occasions. That it's doing so now is ugly. That is pretending that it's doing so out of a concern for good government is grotesque. It's also bad public policy. And he gets into some of the details. It's not quite a carve out. It's a carve out, but it's not quite a carve out. That's sort of a secondary issue. The timing of this is the argument. If you were taking a position against special use districts, of which Florida has some 1,800, like the Villages in Orlando is another example of a special use designation.
Oh, I didn't know.
When you have these places that are so expansive, they cross municipal boundaries and so forth. Oh, okay, you can make an argument from a public policy perspective. So the timing of this is what undermines the credibility of it, according to Charles Cook over at National Review. And this is unnecessary because it doesn't change the impact of the law. The law is the law. DeSantis and Florida Republicans won. There's no reason to spike the football. And so this is an unforced error by DeSantis, so argues Charles Cook, who makes a more grounded argument, certainly, than Jenna Ellis does. That free speech thing is not persuasive at all. But what about Charles Cook? You know, it's been around for 55 years. Now is the time that you pick to go after this designation that Disney enjoys?
Yeah. If not now, when? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick text message.
Bob in Edison Park.
It's a corporate welfare issue, and I'm against corporate welfare anyway, but Here's my issue with these so-called conservatives coming out now against DeSantis. This is what counterpunching looks like. She goes, we as conservatives would be mad if California did this, but the fact is California would do this and has done this. Now that there's some counterpunching, this is what the Republicans or the so-called Republicans have an issue with, and hopefully it's ended. They are afraid to counterpunch. They didn't like when Trump did it, and now they're not going to like when DeSantis did it. And it's disgusting. And I'm glad DeSantis is fighting back. I don't agree with DeSantis on everything, but I think he's wonderful. And this needs to be done. This is what counterpunching looks like. This is a fight. Trump did it. They hated it. DeSantis does it. They hate it. Thanks, guys.
All right, Bob. What about in a world where we go eye for an eye, everyone ends up blind? What about that? We don't want to become them. We could become them. We don't want to. We don't want to be in that business. So the argument, we'd be mad if California did it to Chick-fil-A, and so we should restrain ourselves from doing it if you buy that parallel, which I don't. I'm happy to explain. But if you buy that parallel, so because we would be upset if this happened to a company espousing a conservative viewpoint, we shouldn't do it to a company espousing a Marxist viewpoint.
Well, remember when Mayor Emanuel didn't want Chick-fil-A in Chicago because we don't share the same values?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, that's a right. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to behave like Tiny Dancer, so right. The argument goes. So we shouldn't be doing this to Disney. DeSantis and Florida Republicans shouldn't be doing this to Disney. Do you find that compelling?
It is kind of different. I mean, it's not the same as Chick-fil-A.
I don't, but I'll let people respond first.
Right.
Jim in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. How are you both?
Good. Bowling Green, the Falcons, right? Bowling Green University? The Falcons?
No, that would be in Ohio. That would be Ohio.
Oh,
that's Bowling Green. Of course, Bowling Green, Ohio. You're in Kentucky. I'm sorry.
Come on, Dan. Know your geography. Come on.
Now he's going to go in the tank all day.
All right.
Jim, just go along with it. Kentucky, Ohio, they're near each other.
Yeah, right. What's the difference, really?
Fight fire with fire. Fight fire with fire. This is how the Democrats fight. They would fight like this. We've got to get in the trenches and fight the way they do. We got to bring the fight to them the way they bring it to our side. That's all I got to say. And Jenna Ellis just doesn't want DeSantis running for president. Goodbye.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
Didn't think about that.
Interesting. Monica and Lyle.
Hi, guys. As far as I'm concerned, it looks like it's slightly a bit of overreach on DeSantis. But, you know, government should have been picking winners and losers to begin with. So Disney never should have had it in the first place. And I think as far as Chick-fil-A goes, I think all bets are off now. They want to up the ante, then so are we. We're going to have to start counterpunching. That's all I can say.
Thanks for the call, Monica. There's something else that Charles Cook points out, which I think is a good point. Disney has another carve-out in Florida, if you want to call the special use district a carve-out.
What is that?
In Florida's tech regulation bill, Disney Plus gets an exemption that was not granted to Netflix, Hulu, or HBO Max.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. And so, there's no question that Florida Republicans were playing to their home and providing a carve-out to Disney streaming service they wouldn't provide to the streaming services of companies not located in Florida. And so they don't come to the table with clean hands on rent seeking. Okay. Yeah, I acknowledge that. And Republicans generally don't come to the table with clean hands on rent seeking, much to my chagrin. I acknowledge that, too. But does that mean that you shouldn't take the opportunity to do the right thing when there's an opportunity to do the right thing? So because we were hypocritical once, we should be hypocritical forever. Is that the argument, Charlie Cook? See, it seems to me that, you're right. Republicans could have taken this up any time over the last 50 years when they've been in power, and they've been in power for a while in Florida, and they didn't do it. But you know what? Sometimes, and you know this in politics, and Charlie Cook surely knows this in politics, you know, there is no ability to do something until the landscape is made fertile to do it. And so, and people don't pay attention, or they're willfully blind, or some combination of the two. You can't be running after everything simultaneously. And so let sleeping dogs lie with Disney and its special use district until they present themselves as a target. And all of a sudden people start asking questions. Hey, what about that special use deal they got back in the late 60s? Is that something we should reexamine? And because of them choosing to make themselves a public target, their support for looking at that special use district designation they got back in the 60s, late 60s. And now you're going to do something about it. So, you know, you can criticize the timing because it could have been done at any time, but you can't always get something done any time. It takes the right time. Right. And this is the right time. So you do what you can when you can do it, if it's consistent with principles, even if you've been inconsistent on those principles previously, would be my argument.
I mean,
in support of what DeSantis and Florida Republicans did.
Disney's the state's largest employer. They have 80,000 people. And a payroll of $3 billion.
So?
Plus the Disney Cruise Line.
That makes it even better.
Right.
You know why? Because that's what DeSantis is saying. So? Jared Polis or other governors, you know, move to Colorado. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, Rocky Mountain Disney.
We're not going to cast our lot, and I'm not going to cast my views on particular issues based on what the largest employer in the state has to say. That's not how we do it. And as the Wall Street Journal opined on the topic, in terms of the lesson here, Disney employs nearly 80,000 people in the state, mostly in its theme parks and resorts. Tourism to the area contributes $5.8 billion in local, state, and tax revenue annually when operating at full capacity. But you don't run the state. Your CEO doesn't run the state of Florida.
Right.
And in case you were confused and your strength in numbers are not determinative of majority will in Florida. And just in case you were confused about that, Ron DeSantis and Florida Republicans just unconfused you. Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. You know, this time, corporate welfare has got to end. And, you know, they're just everything you just said, Dan, is absolutely correct on this thing. And I think Illinois, you know, we've got Amazon, right? They've been given, I think, close to $1 billion in incentives from the state of Illinois, County of Cook, Chicago, what have you, to bring all these warehouses here. It's like, you know what, if you want to put your warehouses in Indiana and Wisconsin and then have them drive, have 5,000 trucks drive a few hundred extra miles a day, then go do that. You know, I mean, we've got these TIF districts here in the city, you know, that where the old Finkelsteel is there in Lincoln Park. You know, they're getting $100 million or whatever in TIF money. To build real estate in Lincoln Park? You know, it's insane. You know, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange got TIF money when they bought out the Board of Trade. Where are they going to move to? Fargo? I mean, for crying out loud, it's insane. And what's happened since that deal went down? Those trading floors are closed, so you've got all those clerks out of business. You know, their marketing and clearing departments probably employ less people than they used to because they don't need them anymore. And, you know, they keep bringing all this stuff about, well, we're going to give people jobs. It's all a joke. Corporate welfare's got to end nationwide.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it. John in Villa Park.
Hey, good morning. See, listen, Disney just didn't oppose it on the Florida bill on its merits. They mischaracterized it. They went screaming into the wild like the left does, and that's the issue. So they did it to themselves. Too bad, right?
All right, John. Spencer, Palos Hills.
Yes, I believe back, you know, in the 80s and 70s when Disney was for the kids, you know, let them receive the blessing, you know, through the aid or whatever. But as soon as you go against the children, you lose that. You ain't for the kids no more. You know, so take it away.
Well, thanks for the call, Spencer. I mean, there's something else to that. I'm glad you mentioned that because there is something to government reflecting the social mores of its constituents. And businesses as well. Yeah, there is something to that. The cultural connection to a public-facing business like Disney, just as there should be a cultural connection to elected officials when it comes to their constituents. Yeah, there's something, you know, government aligned with the values of its constituents. That's not a bad thing. Rob on I-57.
Yeah, when you have power, you need to use it. Conservatives are basically disgusted with Republicans because when they do get power, they don't use it. So when you have power, go after it. That's the way it would be.
All right. I would just add, you know, how you use it matters. And so, again, consistent with your stated first principles. You got to be able to make an argument. You know, the argument can't just be because I can do it. It needs to be more compelling than that in a free society. The left's position is I wield power because I can. That's not good enough. Joe in Naperville.
Yeah, I'm kind of old school. A deal's a deal. You make a handshake, it makes a deal. If Disney did something that went against that special carve-out specifically that was made back when they made the deal, then I'd say, yeah, take it away. But I don't think it's right for the government to wield power to make somebody want to change their mind or do something one way or the other. It just really bothers me. It's a very slippery slope.
Well, yeah, I don't think government is doing anything to make Disney change its mind. But there's no indication that the hierarchy in Disney has any desire to change its mind. And I disagree. A handshake deal. You know, handshake deal in government, this is not a contract with the people. A handshake deal, as I said before, statutes change all the time. Or arrangements in law change all the time because something that was contemplated in 1968 no longer is applicable in 2022. I mean, we wouldn't have reversals of terrible Supreme Court decisions like Plessy v. Ferguson if, you know, once some governmental unit has decreed something democratically, small d, then, it shall be in force in perpetuity? No, everything gets reexamined. Right. So the question is the basis for the reexamination and the remedial action that was taken. It's not whether a reexamination is legitimate. It's always legitimate. The question is action taken, rationale for action, which is what we're debating. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Because they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Caitlin Younger has been an academic standout since she started studying algebra in third grade.
Wow, nice.
She took her first AP class as a freshman. She had a 1550 on her SATs as a junior at McKinney High School near Dallas.
That's good.
That's about 50 points off perfection. She will graduate this spring with a 3.95 GPA, unweighted. She's the founder of the school's accounting club. Sounds like a party. She also performed in and directed about 30 plays. She's a high school kid. Sang in the school choir. Scored top marks on the test she has so far taken for 11 AP classes. That would be fives, I presume, in AP, if that's still how they score them. And she helped run a summer camp and held down a part-time job. I'd say that's a pretty good high school resume, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, there's...
Good grief.
She didn't play volleyball, but that's all right.
Yeah.
Maybe she's
yeah.
into the arts more than athletics.
As no, one demerit.
That's an accomplished career.
Yeah, her guidance counselor... Her guidance counselor at McKinney High School says, quote, she is extraordinary, unquote. You know who doesn't say she's extraordinary?
Ivy League schools.
Stanford, Harvard, Yale, Brown, Cornell, Penn, USC, University of California, Berkeley, and Northwestern. She didn't get into any of them.
Well, how was her?
She had a 1550 on the SAT.
I know.
She's got a 3.95 GPA. She has all of these other extracurriculars.
But she's white, I guess, right? Is that bad? Did I say that?
No.
That factors into it? Are you kidding me?
The responses, the Wall Street Journal reporting, are part of a wave of rejection swamping top students who applied on many highly selective schools during the most competitive year on record. And the goes into how Harvard and other Ivy League schools, as well as UCLA, received a record number of applications. And Harvard's admission rate this year is 3.2%. Brown's is 5. Yale is 4.5%.
Tulane's was 8 this year.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I'm just
the Harvard of the Bayou.
It's the Harvard of the South.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And Peyton's not going there. And I think his heart's broken because he really wanted to go there.
The result is that while many less prestigious schools are struggling to fill their classes, the most selective schools are drawing from a broader applicant pool, and that's driving the bar for admissions higher than in past years. Uh-huh. Yeah. So what else is going on?
What's her last name?
For Younger. For the students, such as Miss Younger, the odds are particularly long, writes the journal. She is a middle-class white female from a public high school in Texas who wants to study business.
Uh-oh, Texas bad.
Each characteristic I just mentioned, each one, places her in an overrepresentative group, according to a former admissions officer at the University of Pennsylvania, who's now at a private college. Nearly half of white students admitted to Harvard between 2009 and 2014 were recruited athletes, legacies, children of faculty and staff, or on the dean's interest list, applicants whose parents or relatives have donated to Harvard, basically. So that doesn't leave much room for those who are just high academic achievers and well-rounded young people, frankly. Also, at Harvard, for example, low-income students with top academic scores had an admittance rate of 24%. compared to 15% for all applicants during the time period of that study. That's now down, as I just mentioned, to 3% last year. Because Harvard believes in enrolling a diverse student body, so students learn to work with people from different backgrounds. A private college counselor in New York, the middle class tends to get a little bit neglected. 20 years ago, Miss Younger would have had a good shot at an Ivy League school. Not anymore. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Now, I know the predicate question is, do you want your kid to go to an Ivy League school or a Stanford or Northwestern, period, whether they can get in or not? I understand that's a legitimate question more so than ever. Do you want your kid to go to a four-year university, whether they can get in or not? I understand that is a more pressing question than it's ever been. But let's say you do, or your kid wants to, and specifically the what these admissions counselors are saying, which of course is true, and I'm sure a lot of families have felt the sting of that truth. Middle class in general, but particularly middle class white families, your persona non grata. Pretty much in American society, except to the extent that you will pay full freight and you will be at the back of the line. Well, maybe your number gets punched. But just understand where you are in the lineup, regardless of credentials, regardless of CV, and what you'll be paying if, for some reason, your ticket gets punched. And this is particularly unnerving to me because, you know, I mean, obviously I went to college in a much different time. If this kid couldn't have got into Northwestern, I couldn't have got into Northwestern now either. But this middle-income families being squeezed by the government on behalf of both the top and the bottom. This has been going on for a long time. And now I think there are more people realizing what's been happening, particularly as they come of age. People of my generation, they've come of age and now have kids that are college age or have, you know, or recently college graduates. Well, it's just a little bit different. And I think frankly, it's in part what has been driving this revolt against the ruling class for the past decade plus.
I mean, she's not poor enough to get in. So, yeah, she's being punished because she's middle class, not rich enough, not connected enough to get in, and not poor enough to qualify. Because if she was lower income, she definitely would have gotten in. But that's the reason why people are lying on their college essays, Dan. Everyone now, when you and I went to school, we didn't, well, at least I didn't have to. I don't know if you did. Did you have to write a 700-word essay about yourself and, you know, talk about your hardships and things like that?
There was essays on some of the applications of schools I applied to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, they were different.
Everyone's
yeah.
now. Like, if you go to Stanford, it's a 1,400-word essay you have to write. To go to apply to a California school, you have to write 7 different essays. I mean, it's really time-consuming. But that's why people are embellishing and actually lying on their college essays, because they have to show some type of hardship, something that they've overcome to make them stand out. But they don't want to hear the sports story, you know, like the score was tied, it was in the fourth quarter, but they're sick of that. They want to hear something else. And it's mostly about, you know, my son said to me, he goes, if I write an essay about me being gay or me being, you know, transgender, I'd get into any school in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And one girl in Texas, she wrote that her mom, you know, was dying of cancer and all this. And then they called to do a checkup. Her mom's fine, and her mom picked up the phone and said, I've never been sick in my life.
Mike in Downers Grove.
Hi. I'm half a honky.
Right.
My kid got accepted to Harvard, Princeton, and Yale. And this is a little bit too much whining. I'm all for whining if it's a good thing. Let me tell you mistakes kids usually make. Some kids write their own essays and don't have anybody, including their parents, help them. Mm-hmm. That's a big mistake. You know, I heard a story, and this was only U of I, admissions officer. You know, admissions officer is reading an essay, and the essay said, I always wanted to go to Michigan. So the admissions officer said, I'll let him. From Illinois. Okay, now if you want to go to an Ivy, you got to apply to a bunch of Ivies, not just one, like this kid. Okay?
Excuse me. She didn't apply to one. She applied to virtually all of them, in addition to Northwestern and Stanford and Yeah, so that's
Princeton and Yale were Princeton and Harvard and Yale. Harvard, Princeton, Yale. She applied all three. I don't think that was in the article.
She applied to, I will
Stanford,
tell you.
Stanford, Harvard, USC, Northwestern.
Ivy Leagues. Harvard, Yale, Brown, okay, Cornell, Penn. Yes, so she applied to all.
Here's another thing. If you make the interview, okay, you got to do good at the interview.
Yeah, I saw the Facts of Life when, the Alex P. Keaton, why am I forgetting the name of the show? When he went for this Princeton interview and Mallory had just broken up her boyfriend and then she was crying outside and he had to leave the interview. You remember?
Yes.
Remember that?
And I can't.
That's what drove home the importance of the interview to me is that episode.
Yeah, interview is big, but let me just point out a simple fact. All these schools, the Harvard, Princeton, Yales, they only have like 10%, 15% for alumni. Okay. That means there's an awful lot of alumni kids that don't get in. And here's the other thing. The president of Princeton, okay, told all the freshman parents that were at this meeting, if they wanted kids with perfect ACTs or SATs, they could have a whole class full of them. If they wanted only valedictorians, they could have a whole class of them. I mean, I know white kids that were middle class that went to, you know, Princeton. You know, no big deal. There are spots for them. The one thing they don't tell you is, I mean, Princeton, Harvard, Yale, they all probably have somewhere between 25 and 40 kids going to there from Texas, as they do from Illinois. Illinois is like 40 kids. Everybody has their own range. You're competing against the best of the best of the best. And if you don't have, and a lot of these really privileged kids, the advantage they have is they'll have professionals read them and help them with their essays.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
So Lori Loughlin.
But then you got to get past the interviews. And, you know, even when my kid accepted Princeton, Harvard sent the guy that interviewed him, who was a doctor in Hinsdale, to try to change his mind. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if they want you, they want you. Now, admittedly, I'm half a honky, so, you know, I got that going for me.
Well, which is nice.
The other half.
Yeah. Yes. But here's the thing. So this
is family ties, by the way.
Family ties, yes, right. Yes. Thank you. This isn't about this isn't so much about the Ivy League. I could give a rat's ass about the Ivy League, and parents should tell their children you should also give a rat's ass about the Ivy League.
Right.
I am a firm believer in the Mitch Daniels axiom that it's not where you go, it's how you go. Okay, so just setting that aside. So I'm not complaining about more middle-income honkies going to Ivy League schools. I would discourage people to go to Ivy League schools, just as I discourage people to go to Northwestern. So don't even bother applying. But it is about what's happening to middle-income families. As I said at the outset, middle-income families generally, white specifically, with respect to education, higher education generally, outside of the Ivy Leagues, outside of the premium schools where they take less than 10% of applicants. There is something else going on that we've talked quite a bit about. And you see that, frankly, you mentioned U of I, at state land grant universities like U of I. And I got an example I'll share with you to punctuate that point. But before I do, what about responding to that, Mike?
It's when you're competing against the best kids in the world. Okay, you got a snowball's chance in hell of getting in any of these schools. So I'm still saying, you know, you got to be like the Indian on the corner saying chance to every pretty woman that walks by. And they say, hey, I thought Indians said how. Indian says, me know how, just want chance. You got to maximize everything you do. Okay.
Oh, fair enough.
You got to get that freaking coach or somebody to read your resume, read your admissions letter. I mean, you need an edge.
Right.
Thanks
well, you
for the call.
Consult with like Holly from St. Louis. That's what she does. She's a college consultant. And she helps people with essays, and she helped Peyton with his.
I get that, but I'm talking about I'm not just talking about admission. I'm also talking about, as I said, paying full freight. I mean, Biden is just unveiling his latest student debt loan forgiveness program to continue to sort of backdoor free college tuition, at least for favored sort of political profiled families and students at the expense of others. I'm still talking about the middle income that gets squeezed financially, even if their kid does get into it, U of I or an Ivy League or whatever, just a perceived middle of the road school. and then how the money is distributed associated with that, the respective tuition rates people are paying. But just the U of I story here, too, because, again, this is something different. This is a state university. They have a and should have, like other states do, a commitment to the families in their state, preferential, because the taxpayers of this state have underwritten the university since its inception. So it's different than a private university like a Harvard or a Yale. So this just another real world story. This woman has a senior in the Naperville 203 school district. National merit finalist, perfect score on his ACT.
Perfect score. Wow.
He's an Eagle Scout. He's got a 4.5 GPA. He's recognized as the top jazz guitarist in high school in the state.
Wow.
And he wasn't accepted to the computer science program at U of I, which I understand is going to be more competitive than, you know, going into journalism or something useless. But still. So we're not just talking about smart kid, you know, button down. You're also talking about a servant leader. That's how you have to be a servant leader to become an Eagle Scout.
Right. I know.
We're talking about an artist, top jazz guitarist, in addition to the academic bona fides. And, you know, this rumor, and there's a lot of data to support this rumor being true, that the U of I is still filling their computer science school with Chinese nationals. And they do have a significant portion of Chinese nationals that are paying full freight to go to U of I rather than the state rate for somebody from the Naperville school district. The state of Texas, for example, by contrast, the state universities there are required to take the top 10% of the graduating class at the high school level. They come before all others. That's not the case in Illinois. And now you can argue whether there's some magic number to the top 10% or so on and so on and so forth. And I'm not saying there is, but that attitude that the state of Texas has is the proper attitude when you're talking about public land-grant universities. U of I, as usual in Illinois, everything Illinois, has it wrong. And so now what's this family going to do? We're trying to get all six of our children out of the state. So far, the two oldest have attended schools out of state and will make every effort to keep the other four from attending any college in the state. We not believe the state of Illinois is a good place for young adults to build a future. Right. And as we have said any number of times on this show, Illinois exports more of its college-bound high school seniors than any state in the nation other than New Jersey. It's been that way for decades. So there's your brain drain out of Illinois. Not that you can't be smart and productive if you don't get a college education. I'm not saying that, but let's be honest, too. You've got good students that are on their way to productive careers, generally speaking, a lot of them. Certainly this kid, this Eagle Scout with the jazz guitarist. And you want him to go somewhere else? Well, wherever he goes, that place is going to benefit at the expense of Illinois.
Yep.
And that's an under—
it's taking talent out of Illinois, and then yeah, he's not going to come back.
And
they want us to stay here because they want our kids to live here.
And that's an underreported part of the exodus. Yeah, the wealthy are leaving, and that's a big problem. And the upwardly mobile are leaving. And also the next generation of the upwardly mobile, the talented and the wealth and the will be wealthy are also leaving. So think about that when you go, you know, all the way back to quality of pre-K through post-secondary education, as well as the way that we do post-secondary education here in Illinois as compared to some other states, and who gets squeezed and squeezed out. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We have another instant classic from the Vice President of the United States. Her name is Kamala Harris. She was at Space Force earlier this week to give a little talk on national security, And she used the occasion to explain to the Space Force
it's embarrassing
members in attendance.
Embarrassing. Are you sure you want to play this?
What space is. We got we need the 2001 Space Odyssey theme music.
Here. Spaceballs.
Here's Kamala.
I think everyone here recognizes how extraordinary space is. Whether it is satellites that orbit the Earth, humans that land on the moon, or telescopes that peer into the furthest reaches of the universe. Space is exciting. It spurs our imaginations, and it forces us to ask big questions.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I mean, and the twinkle in her eyes, she was so excited.
Fanfare for the Common Man, there we go. That's what I was trying to grab at.
Intergalactic stellar. And the people behind her.
Big questions, like, is the final frontier, the expanse of space, is that greater than the expanse of space between Kamala Harris's ears? Yeah.
Dun, dun. Wait for it.
I was hoping for a little character, say her to stay in character, and a little bit of a signature cackle at the end, but unfortunately we didn't get that. For more on Team Biden, including this value team member, the Vice President of the United States, pleased to be joined again by Scott McKay, publisher of The Hayride and contributor to The American Spectator. Scott, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. Happy Friday to y'all.
You know, Kamala Harris is just exactly the kind of bootstrapping young lady who made her way through college and law school and on to public office that you write about as the sort of the last battalion for the Biden administration. Kamala Harris is someone that would fit well in the upper reaches of suburbia around major metropolitan areas in this country. So she, in a sense, she is a good representative. Representation of the Biden voter.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably true. But, you know, the thing that strikes me, and this happens every time she gives a speech, is not only is Kamala Harris, you know, exceedingly mediocre and unimpressive, they have enough money to hire speechwriters for her. I mean, there is the budget for that. And I just wonder. I mean, you could dress somebody like Kamala Harris up so that she wouldn't embarrass herself with a good speech that she could read. And yet that never seems to happen. I mean, certainly when she's speaking extemporaneously, it's going to be a disaster.
Right.
I think she's proof of that. She's very much like former President Obama. She is a better speechwriter than her speechwriters.
Well, I mean, that may very well be the case, but it doesn't say much, right? And I just wonder, it's like, with Obama, I mean, they gave Obama speeches that were usually ostentatious and arrogant, but at least the verbiage was somewhat poetic and well-constructed. With Kamala Harris, it sounds like a second-grade teacher, teaching the stupid kids. And, you know, not only does it sound stupid, but it's like an insult to the audience. And I just wonder, I mean, does she insist on writing her own speeches, or do they just have no talent around her? And, I mean, well, I keep reading all of these stories about her staffers who are just running out of there with their hair on fire. So maybe they just, you know, can't get anybody who's any good that's willing to work for her. I don't know.
Well, what does it say that now her, the highest ranking member of her staff has left? I mean, she's had 11 others that have fled. What does that say about a person?
I mean, everybody else is gone. So, yeah, I mean, you see this a lot in a failing business, right?
Yeah,
and everybody's like, I don't want to work here anymore. Yeah. I would say Kamala Harris is very much like a failing business. I mean, there are credible people speculating about whether they will get rid of her before they would be in a position to have her as president.
Well, they're not going to have her as president because she's not going to get elected in this country. We do have some breaking news, too. Babylon Bee reporting that Kamala Harris has flown to Moscow to tell Putin that Ukraine is a country in Europe. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, that's going to be a surprise to him, I imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Russia's a big country, Scott. Ukraine is a small country. What happened, as she'll explain to Putin, is that the big country invaded the small country. Are you following me?
Well, you know, that's kind of like, you know, dangling a rat in front of a snake. You know, it's probably not the greatest idea. But
so
on the other hand, I mean, this is the thing. Do you have any good options? I mean, who do you actually send to talk to somebody like Vladimir Putin?
John Kerry,
I mean,
you can't so they can talk about Harris. Climate change.
You can't send Biden. You can't send Tony Blinken. I mean, do you have anybody in that entire administration who could hold a conversation with a credible world leader without embarrassing the country?
That's good. Yeah.
So go back, though, because you wrote about college-educated women. And so I did want to get to your riff on that and what that says about the college-educated women of America, at least a majority of them, that are still clinging to Biden when no one else is.
Right. Well, we have a little bit of a cultural problem in the country, which is to say we have a massive cultural problem in the country. And it's being essentially fueled in a lot of our colleges, particularly in majors that I guess are supposed to be the humanities or the liberal arts, but are really, you know, something studies, which that seems to be the direction American colleges are moving in as they become more female dominated. And there's a lot less discussion on college campuses and academic settings of objectively real things. And what you get as a result of that is, I honestly, a poisoning of the culture. I mean, I'm sure you've seen this, this graphic that I guess it was in 2020 that Pew Research came back with, and there was this staggering number, like 56% of women between 18 and 29 who identified as liberals who had been diagnosed with some, you know, mental health condition. You know, and that's not a natural thing. I mean, if you have that, what you're talking about is, number one, you're talking about a population that has been, you know, over-therapied, if that's a word. And then secondly, you have a culture that, you know, is based on not coping with things. And, you know, I wonder if maybe this is not part and parcel of an ideological bent to make people more dependent on, you know, whether it's government, the health system, pharmaceutical companies, whatever it is, because this doesn't happen by accident to get numbers like that. And then you see these strange voting patterns, you know, and it's almost, you don't want to be a conspiracy theorist about this, but I mean, you know, even the women's magazines are talking about how miserable women are right now. And you wonder, okay, where does this come from? Like, why are we dealing with this in such a volume that we've never had before?
Yeah, that's sort of the center cut for the dark triad personality type, isn't it? That's what we have here. I mean, just against the backdrop of this, too, because it's a combination of sort of the college educated married to P hats. And then it's also single women who are disproportionately likely to rely on the government. But just in terms of what's happening in education here again and what the mind's eye is, I know stuff like this is, people are inured to it now because it is just so relentless and it has been for years. But this week, the National Council of Teachers of English is calling on English teachers to decenter reading books and writing essays. Students should examine how digital media and pop culture are completely intermingled with language, literature, and writing. The time has come to decenter book reading and essay writing as the pinnacles of English language arts education.
I mean, two words come to my mind, and I'm sure they probably come to yours as well, which is dumbing down, right? I mean, you know, the thing about a book as opposed to a tweet is that a book requires you, you know, to develop your attention span, right? To concentrate on things, to think about large ideas and sort them properly in your head. And to decentralize the teaching of English from the standpoint of books, I mean, you're going to get an entire population full of people who functionally cannot read. I mean, you know, there's no oath of office to be a teacher, but I'd say that's a violation of it if there was.
Moving on to a topic we were talking about a bit last hour, and that's Ron DeSantis's move on Disney, along with Florida Republicans, to rescind their special use district. We've had some conservatives push back and suggest that this is sort of the kind of sort of government retaliation that conservatives would be hewing and crying about if it was targeting a Chick-fil-A or an organization or business that was more center right or Christian oriented in nature. And so Ron DeSantis shouldn't, and Republicans in Florida shouldn't be doing what they're doing. How do you react to what he's done?
Well, I mean, I would, and of course you're talking about like Charlie Cook at National Review wrote that.
Right,
Eric Erickson was a little less demonstrative. He basically called it political theater because he thinks this is all going to get, he thinks this is all going to get wrapped up in the courts. And, you know, my response is, well, even if it is, so what? I mean, the answer is that Disney felt like there was no negative consequence to be had in essentially taking the position that it's right and proper that they should groom people's children for alternative sexualities. Make the obvious point that this would mark Disney as an entirely different company than the one that managed to get that special use district in the first place. And then the second thing is, look, you clearly are not going to stop this, you know, ongoing cultural aggression by playing by the Marcus of Queensbury rules. I mean, the Bush Republican crowd has been giving ground on these subjects for 30 years. So much so that there's really not much of the status quo that's worth conserving at the moment. And so, you know, DeSantis in the Florida legislature comes along and says, you know, look, why don't we go back on offense a little bit and let's teach these people that, yes, there are consequences. And when Disney, you know, is going to lose whatever the number is in hundreds of millions of dollars in tax incentives every year that go away, that's going to clear out the management of Disney because the stockholders are going to insist on it. That's a good thing. And that's something that makes, you know, lasting change. And so my comeback to the establishment that is kind of tut-tutting about this is, well, what have you guys done? You were friends with these people at Disney all this time, and you sat there and watched them turn into a, you know, company basically by and for, the queer agenda. And, you know, they were your friends. You're the ones that defend corporate America as often as possible. And you had no influence whatsoever to make it so that they're not offensive to the majority of the population. Maybe stand aside and let somebody else, you know, try a different method.
Something else, too, on this. Our friend Batya Unger Sargon had a piece about this being the latest in the class wars. She writes, like so many of our other culture wars, this one is about class and the class chasm separating politicians and pundits and journalists from average Americans. It's the class chasm that's really being obscured in the erasure of the videos on libs of TikTok, as well as the fight over the fight with Disney over the parents' rights legislation in Florida. She basically says, look, if the left can focus you on this, then they can avoid having to address the economic, educational, and social capital chasm between them and, you know, the middle working, middle income people in this country.
Well, I don't know that. What I would say is the economic class war and the culture war have somewhat come together in the last, you know, several years because of, you know, this encroachment of woke philosophy on, you know, whether it's the corporate class, the media class, and the people who kind of style themselves the ruling elite in the country. You know, there for a while there was sort of this kind of corporate nice mentality where there were things you're not supposed to say, and then that got kind of derailed into this, you know, woke mentality altogether. And people who are not forced to submit to that, you know, are getting more and more aggressive that, hey, this is not going to be American culture. And, you know, I mean, if I think there are plenty of Republican politicians and pundits and so forth who are, you know, finding a voice to, like, stand against this and realizing that it's, you know, you can risk being canceled now because it's not the end of the world. And so we're having a real fight. I mean, over the last 25, 30 years, you know, there was no fight. It was basically the religious right getting clobbered by everybody else as the country got more, you know, permissive morally, I guess would be a way to say it. But then, you know, it was no longer a question of we were letting people do what they wanted to do. It was a question of turning into deviants the people that wanted to maintain more of a traditional culture and moral value structure. And so, I mean, the main thing is I think the left has gotten so far out over its skis on these cultural issues that, I mean, you know, you have basically Franklin Graham and Joe Rogan on the same side of a lot of these cultural questions. And, you know, that's not a good place to be if you're the Democrats. But, like, you know, I honestly think that sort of the middle class economic structure and the middle class value structure they're not dissimilar at this point, but they are dissimilar to that of the ruling class.
Scott McKay, publisher at The Hayride, contributor to The American Spectator as well. Scott, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, guys, have a good weekend.
Thanks, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The big guy was asked yesterday, given the lawlessness at the border and the surge of illegal migrants attempting to come into this country. You've got a million in fiscal year 2022 so far. Joe Biden was asked, are you sure you want to rescind Title 42? Are you rethinking that at all? And, of course, he gave an answer that has nothing to do with the question that was asked.
This is embarrassing.
Mr. President,
on Title 42, sir, are you considering delaying lifting Title 42?
No, what I'm considering is continuing to hear from first of all, there's going to be an appeal by the Justice Department because as a matter of principle, we want to be able to be in a position where if, in fact, it is strongly concluded by the scientists that we need Title 42, that we'd be able to do that. But there has been no decision on extending Title 42. Thank you.
I watched that in real time, and honestly, how can anybody see that and think that he's mentally capable of being president?
They later, of course, issued a correction to note that there's no appeal to something that has not been adjudicated by a federal district court judge. He conflated the mask mandate on federal transportation with Title 42, of course, in mentioning the appeal. And then he, after that answer, he shook an invisible man, and he was taken away by the Easter Bunny. On a serious and related note with respect to the border, you have this issue of fentanyl, drug smuggling that's going on, and the increase in fentanyl deaths. And this was taken up by Fox and Friends the other day. Matt Capaluto lost his daughter, Alexandra, who is a 20-year-old Arizona State student, to a fentanyl overdose, or I wouldn't really call it an overdose, fentanyl poisoning. She didn't, what you thought she was taking, she was not. And this was his perspective on border security and the drugs coming in addition to the people.
She was on home from Christmas break back in 2019. She was a student at Arizona State University. She was attending there on a full academic scholarship. She was a very smart young lady, but she also suffered from depression and anxiety. And, you know, not that any parent would condone this, but she apparently went on search on social media, Snapchat to be exact, went in search of oxycodone, found a drug dealer that was apparently selling oxycodone, but what he represented to her was not what she got, and she took a counterfeit pill made of a lethal dose of fentanyl that took her life. But I want to mention something. I mean, I'm a proud dad. I could go on and say a lot of good things about my daughter, but the truth is we need to discuss the 300 families that are going to get a call today and the next day and the next day, letting them know that their loved one is dead from fentanyl, because that's how many Americans it's killing a day in America right now. You know, this is just a tragedy beyond epic proportions. And aside from the drug dealer who's directly responsible for taking my daughter's life, we need to be addressing the cartels that are operating with impunity just south of our border, and China, where those cartels are getting the fentanyl from, and we are doing nothing to hold them accountable. You know, I want to point out that within days of Ukraine being attacked, we had hard-hitting sanctions against Russia. We have 300 Americans a day dying from fentanyl stemming from China and Mexico, and we're not doing anything to hold them accountable.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Karine Hajjar. She's a writer for National Review. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on this morning.
So what about that aspect of it? I mean, we've talked a bit about border towns being overrun. We're hearing from local officials in those communities that are near the southern border. But the country not just being overrun by people coming here illegally, also these illicit businesses that as he mentioned, certain Chinese nationals and Mexican drug cartels are engaged in.
Yeah, well, he said it right. These cartels are able to operate with impunity because our border, at least like outside of the stations or where Border Patrol is processing the surge of asylum seekers, is not actually being patrolled by Customs and Border Protection. So with just a rising and rising number of border encounters that increases Border Patrol's caseload, the amount of people they have to process, and they're just going through these people as quickly as possible. Thousands and thousands of them are being released into the country with a court date a month later. And meanwhile, they're not even able to respond to crime and violence on the border, or, you know, drug smuggling and a lot of human smuggling as well.
And I love that in your article you went to Harris Ranch, and tell us a little bit about that, what they have to endure as property owners that are near the border.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking what property owners are having to deal with. I mean, just financially, they're incurring thousands and thousands of dollars of damage. There's a lot of vandalism. There's theft. At Harris Ranch in particular, the owner, John Sewell, has these three giant dogs. So he said that's really the only reason that at least his main home on the ranch hasn't been stolen from. But otherwise, you know, hunting blinds and cabins, and his main business is commercial hunting. So those are being robbed, and the hunt is being ruined for his clients. But then the most shocking part of all of this is he's having groups of 15, 20 single men moving through his property every day. The day I was there, there were 15. And these are the folks that don't want to get caught and that don't want to ask for asylum because they won't qualify for asylum. So take that to mean what you will. And he'll call Border Patrol, say, you know, I have 15 men outside. I need somebody to come get them. Border Patrol is so overrun with work that they say, let them go, let them walk. So those are the people entering the country.
Hmm. We also, you know, had so much furor over Governor Abbott sending a bus with a couple of dozen migrants to Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, as the New York Post has been reporting, and Miranda Devine specifically, we still have these surreptitious flights that are being underwritten by the Biden administration to bring suspected migrants to, well, different parts of the country. She writes, another suspected migrant flight landed in White Plains, New York, late Tuesday night, the fifth such flight in the past 6 days. The iAero Airlines flight from El Paso, Texas, via Jacksonville, landed at 10:33 p.m. The same iAero plane shuttled back and forth between El Paso and New York over Easter weekend. And she, you know, documents this. Ron DeSantis has talked about the same in Florida in terms of him being on watch for similar flights emanating from border communities underwritten by the federal government.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just these flights that are sending people out. The federal government's also funding massive buses to take groups of asylum seekers to, say, like the San Antonio airport. When I was driving back from Del Rio to San Antonio, I was behind one of these buses and, you know, U.S. Army officers driving it. So that's something you see every day. Or from border processing facilities, I was witnessing buses taking the people who had been processed and giving their notice to appear in court. And they're just dropped off at the Stripes gas station there because there's a bus line that goes through there that can take you anywhere in Texas. And then, you know, it's not just these chartered flights either. It's migrants are just released to fly around the country. They're given a document that says they're paroled, which is a type of immigration parole, different from criminal parole. But with that document, they can go through TSA and fly to any destination. So on my flight back to Boston, I noticed some people who are suspected to be migrants, and then I saw plenty of them in different gates throughout the airport.
Wow. Now, were you, NBC News reported last night that about 2,000 Ukrainians have come in through the southern border, but they're not being, they sideswipe. They don't have to go through Title 42. When you were down there, did you meet any of those Ukrainian refugees?
I did not meet any Ukrainian refugees, but you bring up a good point that there are a lot of exceptions to Title 42 right now. So, yeah, groups like that can usually get through and are probably processed in a different way.
Are there any other groups besides Ukrainians that are getting through and don't have to go through Title 42?
Yeah, so there's no hard, fast rule. The New York Times reported on this last year, but that's kind of one of the things with Title 42 is nobody really knows. There's a provision in it for exceptions, but nobody really knows what those exceptions are. At least, like, the broad trends show that Mexican nationals and Northern Triangle nationals, we have a deal with their governments to send them back. But everyone else is kind of has more or less a better chance of getting in, especially family units and unaccompanied minors. That's also an explicit exception. So, you know, what's happening is, you're seeing mostly Colombians, Cubans, Venezuelans, a lot of Haitians. And just in March alone, we had a record-breaking 7,000 number of others, which is just people from faraway countries that aren't your typical demographic for migrants at the southern border. So the message is clear, and people around the world are hearing it, that if you want to come in and ask for asylum, that you have a pretty good shot.
Yeah, and two dozen, as Fox News reported, on the terrorist or in the terrorist database. In addition to that, though, just the news.com reporting, this is John Solomon, that despite these federal district court orders that the Biden administration continue enforcing remain in Mexico, it's not happening. Now, it's now pending before the Supreme Court, but just the news reports, Customs and Border Protection Agency data reviewed by Just the News showed just 199 out of 221,000 illegal aliens stopped by federal agents in March were placed into the Migrant Protection Protocol, the formal name of the Remain in Mexico policy. So it's being ignored for 99.9 91% of people coming to this country through the southern border.
That's right. It's you know, they're all being – I spent the morning with a group of migrants that had claimed asylum and had been processed in an NGO. They were waiting for a bus to take them to San Antonio. And they all had documents that said that they were being processed under alternative to detention. So for some, you know, probably for political reasons, the Biden administration is not wanting to send these folks back to Mexico. They have activists breathing down their neck. So instead of doing that and enforcing the law, they are releasing them under this alternative to detention program where they're given a phone that GPS tracks them. Mm-hmm. One migrant told me he has to take like a selfie a week or something like that. And I also heard reports of $7,000 debit cards and $10,000 or $14,000 for family units, but though I can't confirm that, I didn't see it. But they're being released like that and told to wait for their hearings because Border Patrol doesn't have enough detention space right now, because instead of enforcing MPP, they filled up all the detention space, and now there's nowhere else to go except for into the interior.
So if they take them to other towns, they have to go to the detention hearings in their in that town, or do they have to go back near the border?
They kind of named the place. So I met a migrant who he didn't know anyone in the country. He didn't have family or friends here. So he just kind of said, well, I think I'll go to New York City. And that's where they put his hearing, just as simple as that. So, you know, and these are all people who genuinely, in terms of the asylum seekers I met, they were all people who genuinely want to work, send money home to their families, mm-hmm. come from poorer situations. But they're kind of being released without anywhere to go, a lot of them, and they just name a place and that's it.
Well, and the other problem with that is, while I respect and appreciate that, that doesn't mean you get to skip the line. You're not an asylum seeker, you're an economic migrant.
Right. Yeah. Karine, and the tough part is instead of
No, please finish.
Instead of reforming the system and you know, making it even feasible to do that, the Biden administration, for a political win, just wants to release everyone. So that's what's happening there.
That's a pretty good summation. Karine Hajjar, writer for National Review, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So you've got the DOJ appealing the federal district court injunction on the mask mandate on federal transportation on behalf of the CDC. This after Philadelphia reimposed an indoor mask mandate, which has now been rescinded.
Yes, they said due to decreasing hospitalizations and a leveling of case counts, they've taken away. So we asked on Twitter, what lasted longer, CNN Plus or the Philadelphia indoor mask mandate? Boom.
Close call.
Thank you, Jessica.
That's a close call. That's a photo finish.
It was.
Between the two.
Well, basically, no one was following it anyway, so they just got rid of it.
That didn't stop L.A. County from announcing that the mask mandate is in force at transportation, public transportation centers in L.A. County.
And New York still has their mask mandate for transportation.
And so it continues. And for those of you who don't feel comfortable flying without wearing your face diaper, you know, like mayors of major cities, Dr. Kavita Patel, she's a certified NBC medical contributor, so she must know what she's talking about.
Sure.
She's got some advice and counsel for you.
If people want to stay safe, the best thing they can do, high-quality masks. And that when possible, carry some extra masks. I know this sounds crazy, but if you tell someone next to you on a plane, KN95 and just say, or surgical mask and just say, I've got an elderly mother at home. I've got a child with cancer at home. Will you please do me a favor? Having the people at least closest to you in that row, protecting yourself and them, can be the best safety. So carry some extra masks with you. Carry some rapid tests with you if you're traveling.
When she said, I know it's going to sound crazy, because it is crazy.
But she's going to say it anyway.
You're darn right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I think we've come up with the best response to the manufactured story, according to Dr. Kavita Patel. Just tell them you have a kid with cancer. Tell them you have an immunocompromised grandparent. Okay, it doesn't matter if it's true. She didn't seem to qualify the truthfulness of any such statement. But anyway, I think we came up earlier in the show with a good response to that. Oh, thank you for asking about masks.
Let me tell you my story.
Let's spend the duration of the flight having a little discussion of masks. I've got a bunch of charts and graphs on my phone here. I've got John Tierney's article from City Journal just the other day. We've got a bunch of studies. Let's, you know, as a man or woman of science and data, let's pore over them.
Yes,
let's talk about, let's finally have that big talk on masks and see if you can come over the top in boring them to tears. Not a bad idea. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Dr. Joel Zinberg, Competitive Enterprise Institute Senior Fellow and Director of Public Health and the American Well-Being Initiative at Paragon Health Institute. Dr. Zinberg, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, great to be here.
What about that, Dr. Patel, sort of on the mark, start passing out N95 masks and asking if who wants to take a rapid test with you when you're on a plane?
Well, look, no one, you know, I wrote articles about mandates. People are free to do whatever they want. So if someone wants to wear a mask themselves, if they feel they want that's protective, there's no one that stops them from doing it. The whole question about mandates is whether the government can force you to do it and whether it's, first of all, legal, whether the statute provides that they can do it, and second of all, is it effective? And, you know, the answer to both those questions is, in the first case, no. In the second case, doubtful. So, you know, but of course, knowing if Dr. Patel or anyone else wants to wear a mask, no one stops them.
Well, right. I mean, and nobody's interested in stopping them. But, I mean, it's more just the, I mean, come on. Dr. Patel, carry masks, ask people to put masks on, carry rapid tests. I mean, it's more of the sort of soft peddling of fear mongering that continues in spite of where we are at and in spite of the data and the science. And it should be an affront to right thinking people. It's not about mandates. It's about people like Dr. Patel going on TV and making an ass of themselves.
Well, look, I think it really is about mandates. I mean, and it has been throughout the pandemic. A lot of folks, you know, who are big government advocates have been claiming that, oh, if the government doesn't do this, we're all going to die. And anyone who questions these lockdown measures is a, you know, a mass murderer. And you can go through the entire pandemic and see multiple statements like that. But the fact is, most of these measures had no scientific basis, despite the, you know, always the incantation, oh, we're just following the science. Well, no, actually, they were really just following their intuitions, and there was no science there to support it. And moreover, they've been, you know, completely uninterested in doing the studies that would document the things. And most importantly, they've been completely uninterested in doing a hard look at what are the trade-offs when you impose these sorts of measures, when you throw people out of work, when you discourage them from getting their other medical conditions treated, and therefore they die earlier from other medical conditions other than COVID because they're so scared of getting COVID and because the government won't allow them to go to their physician and get various procedures done. So, you know, this is just the latest in a long line of mandatory government restrictions that, number one, are probably ineffective, and number two, have been struck down by the courts.
Yeah, like today, because I look at this every day, the data. Today, 961 healthy Chicago public school students cannot go to school because they're not vaccinated. So until that's over, this is going to continue. But I just had to get that off my chest, Doctor. Wanted to ask you. I mean,
yeah. Well, then look, that the whole school closure thing has been a scandal. We unnecessarily closed down schools depending on where you live. It could, if you were lucky and you lived in Florida or some state like that, it was a few months. If you lived in Illinois or New York, like I do, it was almost 2 years. So, you know, that's irreplaceable lost education for kids who are, you know, at a vulnerable developing age, developing their language skills, developing their social skills. That's lost, gone, can't be replaced. And it was done on the flimsiest of evidence. And, you know, we've known for the start of the pandemic that kids are not the people who are most seriously affected. Yet there are still people insisting that you need to, you know, either keep the kids masked or vaccinated or not allow them into school.
I wanted to get your reaction to this study that is published in JAMA Cardiology, Journal of American Medical Association Cardiology Journal, that looked at the Pfizer versus Moderna shots among Scandinavian men. For young men who are particularly at high risk of post-jab heart inflammation, the gap was especially significant. 1 million men aged 16 to 24, two doses of Moderna's vaccine would lead to almost 300 hospitalizations for myocarditis and a related illness called pericarditis. Most after the second dose, using Pfizer's shot instead would lead to about 100 hospitalizations. And the difference, Moderna's shot is 100 micrograms. Pfizer's is 30 micrograms in terms of the dosage. And the suggestion in the context of talking about boosters and the continued push for boosters is these higher concentration, these more highly concentrated doses have higher risk associated with myocarditis, at least according to this study. And it's something that we should kick around.
Well, look, it's been known for a long time that there's a risk of myocarditis with these mRNA vaccines, and that the risk is highest in young men. Now you have to also realize there's a risk of myocarditis just from getting COVID itself. But the real question is, in young, healthy men, should you be pushing boosters if they've already been vaccinated? And should you even be pushing, you know, some people are talking about pushing second boosters. And all, you know, that the data seems to indicate that you do get a temporary boost in your immunity if you take one of these boosters. But at the end of the day, after 2-3 months, you're really kind of pretty much back where you were after just being fully vaccinated. And most importantly, you're not getting a tremendous boost in your risk of resistance to severe disease that leads to hospitalization and death. And aside from the fact that in younger people, that risk is vanishingly low if you're otherwise healthy. So, you know, the whole idea of pushing boosters on younger people is particularly second doses of boosters is really a little crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, just for notation here, Sweden, Norway, and Finland have all halted the use of Moderna shots in people under the age of 30. They did that last October, and I don't think a lot of people realize that.
Yeah. Well, look, the Moderna shot has, as you mentioned, carries a higher dosage, so it's in some regards more effective. But you know, when you do that, you have an increase in the side effects too. The good news is that you know the overwhelming majority of these cases, that people recover from the myocarditis or pericarditis. So that's the good news. But that doesn't mean that if you're young and healthy, you should rush out and get a second booster.
I wanted to, the Department of Justice is, you know, reviewing the judge's decision in Florida to remove masks, you know, from planes and trains. And what are so unique about airplanes? Because you have someone like Dr. Jha, who has been, you know, pretty much he's been reasonable pretty much this whole time during COVID, and now all of a sudden he's saying, oh, we need to mask up on airplanes. Is this more about power and control than health and safety?
Well, I think what you have to realize about Dr. Jha is that until recently he was a private citizen.
Right.
Now he's the administration spokesperson. So he's been put in the position of having to lend his scientific credibility to the administration's policies, whether they're, you know, scientifically valid or not. So you've got to take his pronouncements now with a bit of a grain of salt. So, you know, the airplanes have always been a peculiar target for these mandates. There are fewer, there are really outside of a few medical facilities with various, you know, filtration systems, there's no safer indoor space in the world because, planes, they recirculate their air very frequently, much more frequently than any other indoor facility. Half the air that's circulating in the cabin is fresh air brought in from the outside, so that's virus-free. The other half is circulated through these HEPA filters, which take out 99.9% of viruses. So, and the way the air circulates in an aircraft is from top to bottom and not along the length of the aircraft. So everything in there is designed to limit the spread of airborne pathogens. So there are few places that are as safe as being on an airplane. Yeah. Now, you know, you could argue that, look, when you're in the jetway on the way into the plane, sometimes people get stuck there. It's not, it doesn't have that kind of ventilation system. Although, you know, as you know, anyone who's taken a flight out of Chicago in the winter knows there's plenty of air circulating through the cracks in the jetway. But, you know, arguably that's a little more dangerous, but it's never made sense for the airplanes to worry about this. And it makes even less sense now, when you have Omicron, which appears to cause much less serious disease.
So when Jen Psaki said earlier this week in response to that Florida District Court judge's injunction explaining why the Biden administration opposed it, she said that we've seen an increase in cases from airplanes. There is, and of course, she provided no citation or data, but there is no citation or data for her to provide, is there?
No, certainly not that I'm aware of. And if you read that transcript and you listen to her, she almost kind of threw that in at the end, as if, oh gee, I got to get the word airplane into the sentence. So. So I don't think there's any evidence of an increase. There are increased cases, very small increases, but increases in some localities, but they're not increases that anyone's traced to airports. But more importantly, what she fails to acknowledge is that there hasn't been a bump up in hospitalizations or deaths. And granted that those lag behind an increase in cases, but we've had the Omicron variants have been circulating now for months. And even the BA2 variant has been circulating, has been dominant for 3-4 weeks already. You would have expected to see a big jump in hospitalizations and eventually deaths if it was going to be a problem, and you don't see that. And those are the metrics that the CDC 2 months ago said should guide indoor masking. So,
not anymore.
Look, this is what they said. They changed their own guidelines. It used to be just cases and positivity rates, and then they dropped the positivity rates. And they said, yeah, it's cases, but more importantly, how many new hospital admissions and what percent capacity are the hospitals at with COVID patients. And those are, incredibly low. There are very few hospitalizations, and they're not even close to straining the capacity of hospitals. So, when the CDC extended the mandate just about not even 2 weeks ago, they were basically ignoring their own guidelines because their own guidelines say you don't need indoor masking unless you're in what's called a high-risk community. And when the day that they made that extension, less than 0.5% of communities in the United States were high-risk under their own metrics. But, they went ahead and did it anyway. So one could argue it's kind of theater. And at the moment, their appeal of the case has nothing to do with current risk. It really has to do with preserving their own power for the future. And they've said as much. I mean,
yeah,
Jen Psaki said that on an interview.
That's right. Dr. Joel Zinberg, Competitive Enterprise Institute Senior Fellow and Director of Public Health in the American Wellbeing Initiative at Paragon Health Institute. Dr. Zinberg, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care then.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Open mic. Open mic Friday.
calling now. Open Mic Friday.
312-642-5600 is the number. Turnkey.pro answer line. Taking your calls with comments, compliments, critiques, general crack pottery. We'll take it all.
And you started with wanted to start with a hard subject.
Well, she lived a hard life. Cynthia Plastercaster Al Britton, passing away after a long illness. I bet it was long. At the age of 74, she became infamous in the 60s and 70s for her plaster casts of rock stars' erect penises. And I'm standing at attention right now in her honor. There it is. Jimi Hendrix was her first.
Really?
Yeah. And the sad thing about this, she's a Chicagoan originally. Southsider.
Southside!
The sad thing is she passed before she had an opportunity.
To what?
To put a cast around that prodigious unit that Mayor Triple Threat says she's lugging around. So it could be preserved for posterity.
That would have been fantastic.
Oh, boy.
God, she just didn't live long enough. Darn it, Dan. Don't bring me down.
Yeah. All right, a related story, this listing for a home in Wisconsin.
Yes.
Apparently the listing agent didn't take any notice of this signage in the boudoir of this home. And it turns out maybe he just is a bit desensitized because the home he was selling was that of his brother and sister-in-law.
Yeah.
But
what was in the bedroom, Dan?
But in the bedroom, yes. Above the bed, is the signage, very pronounced. Welcome to Pound Town.
Oh, yeah. Insane in the memory.
Pound Town is
Pound
little,
Town, baby.
Little suburb outside of Milwaukee is where Pound Town is located, apparently.
So they had that up in their bedroom?
Yeah.
Welcome to it's Pound
big,
Town.
It's a big, like, embroidered sign right above the headboard. And so I suppose, and by the way, the home sold in 3 days, so apparently people didn't mind. That didn't stain the room for them, if you will.
Uh-huh.
But I think you keep the sign and then you just put, there's a new sheriff in Pound Town for the new owners.
Oh, yeah. Where the fun come to play. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Welcome to Pound Town. Class act, that couple.
I got to see, is that online anywhere? Are you going to tweet
it? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll tweet it out. All right, let's take a couple calls.
Okay, 312-642-5600. And if you're to get a busy line, just keep calling back and maybe you'll get on.
Tony Southside, the home
Good
of
morning.
The plaster caster.
Yes, sir. I might have an encounter with her, but I'm not saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good morning, Amy, my Lammy Lamb and Daniel. So I wanted to share my encounter with an individual regarding that lady who was saying hand somebody a mask or a test kit, that which is insane. So I was out in the Vanilla Village shopping, you know, and this is during the height of COVID when they had, you know, the little squares that, you know, 6 feet apart things, right? So I'm in line. There's a lady in front of me, an elderly lady. And at some point, she turns around and looks at me and asks me to step back a few feet. I'm like, well, lady, I'm on my little dummy box here. You know, I'm cool. She goes, but you don't understand. My husband's at home with a compromised immune system. I said, well, lady, maybe you shouldn't be shopping at needless markups. Goodbye. And that was the end of that story.
All right, Tony. Yeah. Very good.
That's how you fight back, man. You fight back like that.
There you go. Ow. Thanks for the call, Tony. Rick in Downers Grove.
Hey, good morning. Hey, last week when you had John Cass on, you know, because you like soccer, and there's a billion reasons why soccer's not a sport, and I happen to think of another one.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned basketball. You know, you take basketball, and the hoop's not much bigger than the ball, yet those athletes can get the ball in that hoop many, many times, even with somebody guarding them. Now you move on to soccer, an activity, you know, like tying your shoe, you know, it's kind of like that.
Calisthenic.
It's got a goal the size of a house, yet the supposed athlete can't get a tiny ball in that gigantic goal. And that's a sport? I think not.
That's a great point, Rick. That's a good one. I'm going to have to share that with Cass. I think I'm doing his Chicago Way podcast next up. I think I'm doing it tomorrow. So
Oh, really?
I'll have to share that with him. That is a good one. I mean, in addition to, as you say, the myriad other reasons why soccer is not a sport. Oh, John in Lincolnwood.
Oh, hi, Dan and Amy. You wanted to call earlier because you were talking about the colleges and all those I don't know if it was a boy or girl that couldn't get into the college that they wanted to. My daughter, very good student, AP classes, amazing, 4.34 average and all this. Anyway, long story short, she applied to the University of Michigan, University of – I'm the one that called and told you I was visiting colleges. She got turned down by almost all those colleges, and I was shocked. And University of Miami, that turned her – everybody, I mean, they got like 49,000 applications and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very proud, and she got into Pepperdine.
Wow. Good.
Oh, all right.
Only 85,000 a year.
Yeah, exactly. You're very proud, and you're going to be very poor. But
exactly.
Congratulations. But, you know, hey, the good news is while you're shucking and jiving to make ends meet here in Chicagoland, she'll be enjoying college in Malibu. So
absolutely.
It's all worked out
absolutely.
For her. All right. Thanks, John. Elliot Wilmette.
Hey, Amy and Dan. It's great to have you back, Amy. The best thing I heard written about Biden's problems recently was at some presser. They said that he appeared to be as lost as last year's Easter egg.
Hi-oh.
That was hard to read, I thought.
Thanks for the call, Elliot. Holly in St. Louis.
Oh, hi, Holly.
Okay, I have to say something, Dan. When you're on hold and you take a long time to go, and then you don't get picked, that's pretty annoying.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It just stings, doesn't it? It stings.
It just, yeah, and to think you're in your standing situation.
It's like being picked, you know, it's like being picked like middle to end of the pack for teams and as a kid.
Well,
you know I'm looking at your name and I'm not selecting you.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Hey,
no.
I'm opposed to the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida because as a parent of imaginary kids, you probably remember this. When your kids are in elementary school, their word gets out who the good teachers are and who the bad teachers are. And you just spend all summer praying that at registration your kid gets Miss Smith instead of Miss Jones. Mm-hmm. And I think that they should advertise. Miss Smith is going to teach reading, writing, and arithmetic. Mr. Jones is going to teach activism and transgender studies. And I think parents should get to pick which education track their kids are on.
If only they were that transparent, Holly, I could potentially agree with you. But you know they're not that transparent, don't you?
No, but that's why I'm opposed to the bill, because it makes it less transparent. So it makes them sneakier.
No.
I think instead should blow the whole top off of it. And they should proudly say we're going to teach activism and transgender in our class.
Yes, but unfortunately, they're a little bit more politically savvy than that. They're never going to tell you who they actually are, what they're actually doing, because they know they can't sell it. I mean, per your point of, are they selling we're opposed to the parental rights bill? No, they're selling we're opposed to the Don't Say Gay bill, which has nothing to do with the legislation. They're never going to be honest. So, no, that's just you're not going to get that sort of transparency. They cannot win if they are forthright about who they are and what they're intending to do. They know that.
Exactly. There are going to be three kids that have two moms and two dads, three kids in their classroom. Meanwhile, the other classrooms are going to be packed chock full, because when push comes to shove, parents want their kids to learn reading, writing, and arithmetic, period.
All right. Thanks, Holly. Dan in Green Oaks.
Yes, Dan and Amy, just wanted to give you the results of last night's candidate rating for the Republican Assembly of Lake County. We voted on it, all the races. The governor's race, candidates were rated highly qualified, qualified, no rating, or unqualified. The results were Darren Bailey, highly qualified, Max Solomon, Gary Rabine, and Paul Shemp, qualified, Jesse Sullivan, no rating, Irvine, unqualified.
Oh, really? Irvine unqualified. Why is Irvine unqualified?
Basically, you got to be a Republican. And
you have stiff litmus tests. Yeah, that's very, very, it's very difficult. Okay, all right. Thanks for the call, Dan. Good to know.
I'm gonna try to talk to him tonight.
That's new. You got to be a Republican to be a Republican nominee for governor. When did that start? Rich in Indian Head Park.
Oh yes. Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Amy, nice to have you back this week. What I'd like to say is I agree with Governor DeSantis. I believe that small children should only have to concentrate on reading, writing, and math, and not have to worry about whether they're boys or girls or whether they're privileged or not privileged. That's the first thing. The second thing is Tikkun Kamala, the only word that I can use to sum up her is embarrassing. Have a nice weekend.
All right. Thanks, Rich. Dawn, Naperville.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for taking my phone call. I came across a non-for-profit organization on a Moms of Special Needs Facebook page I belong to. It's called Hope, and they are sponsoring a prom for special needs kiddos. It's on Thursday, June 23rd at the Bolingbrook Golf Course from 5 to 10 p.m. So if you go to hopespecialprom.com, you can go ahead and register. You have to register in order to be allowed in. And if you are not able to attend, but you want to sponsor or volunteer, Amy, if you want to go and attend another prom or maybe
sure. She's already the record holder.
Prom,
yeah.
I'll think
you
about
can
it.
Just text special prom to 44321. So spread the word. Just encourage other kids to go.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dawn. You are the North American record holder, but you could separate, you know, provide more distance between you and second place if you went to another prom.
That's true.
Yeah.
It might look creepy, though, for me to go to prom right now.
Was it any creepier when you were going in your 30s?
Stop it.
You never got
to go to prom, you poor thing.
And that's, well, that's right. Poor Dave in Racine, Wisconsin. That is, hey, Dave, do you know where Pound Town, Wisconsin is by any chance?
Not familiar with that.
Gotcha.
It's probably the entire state is that if you go by the using pound as for our overweightness.
Yeah, okay.
But
go ahead.
My comment is that not to assume a red tsunami / Democrat defeat in the midterms. I cite two quotes, one from Han Solo, "Don't get cocky, kid," from Star Wars Episode 4, The New Hope, and the other is from Boris Badenov, "Never underestimate the power of a schnook."
All right, Dave, thanks for the call. Why did I know Dave would cite the Star Wars episode of that Han Solo quote? That feeling. No. Joe from Plainfield.
Hey, I'm a longtime listener, and I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning just to get ready for your show. I love you guys.
Thank you.
Anyway, I want to tell you what I tell people when I go to stores and they tell me hello. I ask them, how many times a day do you say hello? May I suggest a change in terminology for psychological effect? Everyone knows hell is low. Why talk about it? It brings people down. Bring them up with hi, howdy. Anything but hell, he don't need no help.
All right, Joe.
Thanks for sharing that. God bless you.
God bless you, too.
Joe. All right. I did say crack pottery is welcome, so I brought it on ourselves.
That's very nice.
I know that this guy knows where Pound Town, Wisconsin is. Chuck from Delavan, Wisconsin.
Down.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, I've been through there. I actually go to the VFW there. Hey, I want everybody to drive all the way to the gun show up in Kenosha tomorrow because I'm going to be standing outside. I am collecting 3,000 signatures to get my name on the ballot for U.S. House of Representatives District 1, where Paul Ryan used to be the congressman.
Yeah, but then Ryan Stiles now, right?
Yeah, he was just the driver. That kid has no qualifications. Paul Ryan knew that he wouldn't win. I want everybody to turn around and do themselves a big favor. Look up October 8th, 2016, when Paul Ryan conceded the election 1 month ahead of time, and he would not let Donald Trump attend Pumpkin Festival in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. I'm taking this kid down just for that because he drove him there that day.
He did not know
that he was going to be looking at the back of Tangerine Jesus's head the following 2 months.
It's Brian Style. I was confusing him with the guy from what
Dancing with the Stars.
Well, no, Ryan Stiles is that Canadian comedian who's on the Whose Line Is It Anyway? You know, that Drew Carey used to host and others before.
Oh, yeah,
that's Ryan Stiles. Yeah. Brian Stiles.
Him that day.
Yeah, I kind of like Brian Style, though. Yeah. I got to tell you, Chuck, I mean, I might like you more. But all right, we'll get you on the ballot. That'd be a fun primary. I assume you're running as a Republican?
No, I'm running on my own ticket. I got when I ran it for 2018, the Republicans did not let me debate Nichols or Vukmer, and I finally got the chance to, and they would not let me be on TV, and I finally got a chance to debate them on WTMJ, and I ended up winning. I got 55% with 4 one-minute questions. You can look that up, too. So I'm taking them down. They did not help me, and I made my own party. It's called the Going Away Party.
The Going Away Party. Chuck from Delavan. All right, Chuck. Good luck with that. Rick in Aurora.
Yeah, hey, Dan and Amy. How are you?
Good.
Hey, Amy, I think you're going to an event with Rich Irvin or something, isn't it?
Yes, I'm going to attend that event. Yes, it's tonight.
I have coffee.
She loves being lied. She's like Fleetwood Mac Lie to Me. That's a little lies. Johnny Lang is Lie to Me. That should be Richard Irvin's theme music. Go ahead.
Well, you know, he's an interesting character out here. Hey, I had coffee with an officer that was just at an event, a police officer that was just at an event with Rich Irvin, four police officers, and there was the topic of sanctuary cities came up, and Rich declared that Aurora was not a sanctuary city, even though in 2019 he praised J.B. Pritzker and Lori Lightfoot and prohibited our officers for working or assisting ICE in any possible way. When he was asked by a officer that works for Kane County Jail about why can't we hold inmates on ICE detainers unless they have a federal warrant, Rich Irvin claimed that he was going to change that. And that'd be an interesting thing to make sure that we know exactly where he stands on, you know, working with ICE, sanctuary cities. You know, at one point he praises J.B. Pritzker, prohibits our officers from working with ICE in any way. And then on the other end says that, no, Aurora is not a sanctuary city. So I think I'd like, you know, you could follow up with him. That'd be great.
All right. Thanks for the call, Rick. There you go, Amy. You've got your charge. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.